This is Archival Moments on VOCM. For the next hour, we'll explore the great stories and traditions that can be found in the archives of Newfoundland and Labrador. Archival Moments with Larry Doey and Brian O'Connell on VOCM.
From the rooms in St. John's, welcome back to another edition of Archival Moments. My name is Brian O'Connell and Larry Doey, our host, archivist, and director here at the rooms. Thanks for having us again.
Welcome back.
Well, always a pleasure. This is a very busy time of year coming in. Well, it's always busy here at the rooms, but coming into summer season, it's especially busy.
Well, these tourists are underway, yeah. And we have already noticed that a number of tourists are here in town, you know, small conventions and all of that. So, and they're all making their way up the hill to the rooms.
Well, we encourage you to do that. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the rooms. We'll tell you about that throughout the show today. Plus, we're going to talk about icebergs in Newfoundland and Labrador because it is the season.
It is the season, and there are many.
And Trepassey, back to Trepassey. We're going to talk about Trepassey's adoption by America.
That's right, because the Americans spent the month of May in Trepassey back in 100 years ago, in 1919.
So we start with big fashion changes in St. John's. So.
Imagine that, fashion in St. John's 100 years ago. So I was just going through some of the newspapers and looking at some of the... I'm a very fashionable person. I know fashion. You know fashion. More than
you're,
I know
you're
fashion.
You're too kind.
Anyhow, so I was just looking through some old newspapers and I stumbled across a newspaper, a story. And so the story was speculating about women about the town, going about the town, and they are hatless.
Hatless.
Imagine, 1919, 100 years ago, and women are not wearing hats. And so the guy who's writing the article is actually really a bit quite... put off by it all. Yeah. He's really surprised because typically the tradition was that women would definitely be wearing hats, especially in public. And so he was there and he said, is this going to, take root? Is every woman going to be hatless? Hatless women the next big fashion statement?
He wrote in the Telegram, "The fair sex's very latest craze are women going without hats in the near future. Already it is a craze which is rapidly increasing. Why the move from hats to hatless women?"
So I did a little digging there, and so what's after happening, of course, is that one of the primary ways that women felt comfortable taking their hats off was because women started to go, as men as well, but women were going to the theaters, and so this new production, film and was showing on the screens, and women were going, and they were going, and they were wearing these big old hats. And of course, if you're sitting behind a woman wearing a hat, that you're going to say, "Get that hat off! I can't see the screen."
So I'm curious because I've always heard and read these jokes. There was always these jokes about women with hats in theaters, and that's where that came from.
And it actually became compulsory for women, ladies, to remove their hats because they obstructed the views. And they were encouraged, though, so the hats came off, but in the theater they were only wearing a net over their heads, so they would have like a tissue or a piece of cloth. And that was 1919, St. John's, Newfoundland.
In the old country, Britain, three very influential women, Lady Rhonda, Miss Mary MacArthur, and Miss Susan Lawrence, among famous women speakers, have joined the No Hat Brigade when speaking on public platforms. In many of the law courts, women witnesses now give their evidence hatless, while at picture palaces, at race courses, and at other places of amusement, both indoor and outdoor, more and more women are taking up the new craze and going about hatless.
Well, it was really quite shocking. And sort of the hatless craze was actually been driven by these three influential women. These were three British subject women that were very involved with the suffragette movement, women's movement. They were being very political, and part of that political statement was not wearing a hat in a public space.
Now, I remember my grandmother having a collection of hats, and I do remember of a certain age when she was with us. When she went out, she always wore a hat. Always.
always wore a hat, and so most women know the term, most of us growing up around the Bay, we always, you know, a woman would never go out, she'd have a bandana.
Yes,
on.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, bandana, that was the term for it. And so mother had lots of bandanas to match, like, different shirts and pants and, you know, dresses and all that kind of stuff. So they had a big collection of bandanas.
How did this custom start?
So the bandana custom is actually at a it's a church.
Uh-huh.
So in the Christian church, in all churches, in most religions, women were always encouraged to wear a hat or to at least cover their head. And it's a prohibition that's in the Christian church. So there was St. Paul. So St. Paul in the book of Corinthians, you know, in the New Testament,
yeah.
He wrote that essentially a woman who was had a place of respect in the community should always have the head covered.
He wrote, "Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that for a man to wear long hair is degrading to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her pride, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is disposed to be contentious, we recognize no other practice, nor do the churches of God."
So based on St. Paul in the New Testament,
yeah.
What happened in all Christian churches, women were encouraged to wear a covering mm-hmm. on their head. Now that over the years in Newfoundland and our culture became the bandana or
yeah.
scarf. And but over the years that the churches gradually moved away from that teaching. But in fact, you know, if you were going to the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, it's not until October of 1976 that women are given notice that, yes, the church is okay with you coming to the church
yeah,
with your head uncovered.
Now that you mention that, yeah, that timeline seems quite accurate, yeah.
And so what happened, so on October 15, 1976, the church put out a statement. Well, the statement was actually about the ordination of women and talking about the role of the women in church. And that statement said that such as the obligation imposed upon women to wear a veil on their head, such requirements are no longer have a normative value. So basically, in that document written in 1976, was the first time that official sanction
yeah.
was given to women to say, you're no longer required to wear a covering over your head.
Okay, so, I mean, hats are still around. Where do you have to wear a hat then?
Well, one of the places, and this is another Catholic tradition, so if you appeared, for instance, before the Pope,
yeah.
you would definitely wear, or women definitely would wear some kind of a head covering.
And what about the Queen?
The Queen is really interesting. Yes, most women would definitely wear some kind of a head covering. So what was it? William Shakespeare said, like, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Well, Queen Elizabeth II
yeah.
can't wear a crown
no.
all the time, but she's very big on hats. And so apparently...
Well, she is, yeah, and has quite a collection.
And these are very colorful hats.
Yeah.
But now, so it's said by her biographers and, you know, the police, people that are close to her, that she has worn 5,000 different hats in the past 50 years.
So I would imagine she has a castle for her hats.
She has some size of a closet for her hats.
5,000.
5,000.
That's amazing.
And so until the 1950s, ladies were very seldom seen without a hat, and it was not considered the thing for ladies to be showed her hair in
yeah.
public. But, you know, in some senses that has changed. And so someone within the royal family was one of the big movers in terms of making at least the monarchy feel comfortable not wearing hats.
And who would that be?
And that was Princess Diana.
Oh, you're right.
So Princess Diana, when you look at photographs of the royal
family... There are
family,
a lot in which she doesn't wear a
there's
hat.
There's lots
yeah.
where she doesn't.
I mean, she does have... There are photos with her with hats yeah. on, but mostly without.
And so her biographer actually said that... And so Diana was questioned about it. You know, like everyone else in the royal family is wearing, you know, these beautiful hats and... And she said, well, you cannot cuddle a child when you wear a hat. So her logic was, you know, I engage in a lot of occasions where I'm meeting especially children. I like to cuddle children, and you can't wear a hat when you cuddle a child.
So let's just go back to Queen Elizabeth again. Her outfits are quite colorful.
Very, very colorful.
The hats are very, very ornate. I mean, they're just magnificent. Why?
The reason for that, all that bright color, is because wherever she shows up, you know, typically, you know, there's crowds that will gather. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be 15, 20 deep.
Sure.
And so her rationale for wearing bright colors and especially a bright hat is so that people can pick her out in the crowd. So basically she's trying to accommodate the audience that comes out to see her. At least someone can say, well, I saw a glimmer of Queen Elizabeth as she passed by. And she's trying to accommodate that. She wants her audience. She wants the people to see her whenever she's out, and that's how she does it.
I guess if you're going to stand for hours and hope to see the Queen, she wants to make sure that you at least get a glimpse of her.
That's right. All that's right.
100 years ago in St. John's. And of course, people didn't think the hatless craze would catch on, did they?
They certainly did not. So it was really quite the... really quite the surprise. Now, in Newfoundland, it continues on into, like, this is 1900 years ago, but certainly by the 1950s, 60s, the hat makers are out of business.
Now, I'd like to explore this further because there was an Ellen Carberry.
So Ellen Carberry is really well known here in Newfoundland.
Yeah.
She was a millinery. So a millinery is, you know, it's just a fancy word for a hat maker.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious, why a millinery? So a millinery, actually, the meaning of that word, millinery, is actually refers to an inhabitant of the city of Milan. So the city of Milan in Italy was one time known as the most famous, you know, the fashion center of the world. And so a millinery became a hat maker. And one of the most famous in St. John's was Ellen Carberry. So way back in 1887, Ellen Carberry opened up a hat shop in St. John's, and she was very, very good at it. Unfortunately for her, in 1892, her shop burnt down. But Ellen Carberry was pretty smart. So she saw that the fire was raging. It was headed down towards her shop. So she went into her shop with friends, removed all of her hats, all of the gear that she would need for making hats. And as a result of that, she was able to reestablish her business very quickly after 1892. And so she set up another then thriving business down on Duckworth Street. And so she was also one of these, she not just hats, but she did other dresses and, you know, women's clothing generally.
Yeah.
And she was one of the first women, she was the first woman who said, well, I'm not sending some man over to London to buy my hats and the materials for making hats.
Yeah.
I'm going to go myself.
Huh.
And one of the last trips that she went on was 1915. 1915, the First World War is on. And she always made it a point of visiting with the soldiers. And so back in September the 3rd, 1915, she visited Aldershot, England, not far from London, but she knew a lot of young fellas from the Newfoundland Regiment were there, so she went to visit them. And then she wrote a letter back to Newfoundland, you know, talking about who the boys were and who she'd seen and, you know, their conditions and stuff. And then she, the next day, got on a ship, but unfortunately that ship was torpedoed and she died on that ship on September the 4th, 1915.
Wow, that's an incredible story. She
it
was a poet and a writer as well?
A poet and a writer, yeah. And so she wrote extensively for local papers and commenting on, but she was also a poet. And so I think we have, or we know of about 70 poems that she wrote and 24 articles in local publications. But this was also, so this was another reason why Newfoundland became hatless, was because women like Ellen Carberry were now felt, you know, they had their own place in the world. They were now responsible for their own businesses. They'd taken the place of men during the First World War. And so, and in the shops and in the manufacturing places where they worked, you know, they weren't wearing hats and bandanas and bandanas and there. And so now they felt a little more enlightened. And you had people like Ellen Carberry now. So her shop is closed down. So now there's actually fewer places where you can go to buy the product.
So much about hats and going hatless in St. John's back in the day.
Who would have thought? A fashion statement 100 years ago this month in St. John's.
We're going to move along and talk about Trepassi and how it is adopted by America when Archival Moments continues on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
This time around, Trepassi being adopted by America. Now, we talked about the naval vessels visiting Trepassi in a previous show, and this time around, we delve a little deeper into that because there were a lot of newspaper reporters who showed up. How many naval personnel showed up in Trepassi for that visit?
So we did do this before, and there was a lot of people, especially from the Trepassi area, were really keen on finding out a little bit more, and so we did dig in. So we do know that in May, between the 6th of May and the 16th of May, in 100 years ago, there were about 8,500 American naval officers in Trepassi.
How many people would have been in Trepassi living there at that time?
Trepassi, you're talking about maybe about 800, and I might be exaggerating.
So then 8,500 people coming into your community.
That's right. So there's 8,500 who are looking for all of the amenities that these American soldiers have been accustomed to. And so they're there, and they're wanting to enjoy the amenities. So, in fact, there's a newspaper headline, and it says, Trepassi is adopted by America. South Shore town takes on appearance of one of the American naval bases in Uncle Sam's Land. So it must have been incredible to look.
What did they do there?
So what the Americans did when they arrived, of course, they quickly realized that a lot of these men that have been living on these boats, 8,500, they want to get into the town. They want to enjoy the town, but they quickly realize the town, for instance, has one shop. And so what the Americans have to do, they started erecting tents, a quadrant or a square. Yeah. And in that square, then, they had these tents, and they had shore canteens where they sold soft drink, cigarettes, tobacco, and other luxuries, right? Because the town simply didn't have them.
I guess some of that stuff was not available to people in Trepassi.
And certainly not available. But they had one shop there, and within the first couple of hours, like the first of the Americans arrived, and they went into this little shop and they bought the shop out, right? And so then the Americans realized, well, you know, there's lots of local entertainment, but the entertainment, you know, they're only small spaces. Mm-hmm. But the town did have one substantial, a big hall, and that was the Temperance Hall. So what they did, they rented the Temperance Hall, and that's where they set up the ship's band, and the ship's band in during the course of the day and the evening, they play some, you know, selections of music, and it's said that there were some very excellent singers and good musicians. But then I read another article, and it was really funny, that a lot of the people in Trepassi were listening to this music, and it was, you know, some of it had a classical bent. There was music that was new to their ears, and so the locals would quickly you know, sort of take over and turn it into, you know, a dance. Well, they'd bring in the accordions and the fiddles and the, you know, the guitars and tin whistles and stuff. You know, the American stuff was good for a little bit, right?
Yeah.
It's like listening to the accordion. You can take it, like, for three or four songs, but then you need a voice, right? And here's these Americans, and they think they're top dog with, you know, their trumpets and all this, and that's when the locals step in and say, let's listen to some of our music.
So it must have been quite a financial windfall for the community.
Oh, it would have been, because you know, you had this surge. But it could have been much better. In fact, a lot of people were speculating. The newspapers were speculating, you know, if you had some young entrepreneurs in Trepassi, because the newspapers were basically encouraging some of the young people to, you know, they should get on the train, get into St. John's, and bring out the product that these Americans are looking for. Because the Americans were not allowed to leave the passage.
Okay.
You know, they were confined to that space. But the locals could easily have left, gone into St. John's, made all these big purchases, and brought them back. But really, the locals didn't know how long they were going to stay there, and they certainly didn't want to get stuck with the packages.
Now, we turn to the battle of the newspapers. One newspaper criticized another. Tell us about that.
So the last time we spoke about this, I made reference to the Evening Telegram having a reporter down in Trepassey, and he was talking about, you know, the for instance, one of the storylines that the Evening Telegram reported on was that the locals were so amazed at the fact that they've seen the first seaplanes down there. They're looking up into the skies and they're awestruck. You know.
So who was criticizing the Telegram?
So it's another St. John's paper, the St. John's Daily Star. So you have two newspapers, and both got representatives in Trepassey. The Evening Telegram fellow, when he writes, he talks about how in awe the people of Trepassey were. Like, they were just looking up into the sky, and they were all trying to figure out how this plane is staying up in the sky.
He embellished it a little bit.
He embellished it a bit, right?
So what did the Daily Star, they wrote this article?
So the Daily Star then wrote an article.
The extracts which you have wired from one of the evening papers, the Evening Telegram, yesterday are declared as puerile and greatly exaggerated nonsense. The few people to whom I have shown these extracts are indignant and consider they've been held up to ridicule. The scene depicted of the natives gathering and discussing what made flying machines go and how it was kept in the air is untrue and a reflection of the good sense and intelligence of the people here. And if the writer had been present at the railway station last evening when the men at this place heard it read from my message, he would not stand long on the order of getting away toward the city. He might have been raised a little in the air.
So basically he's saying, so what's after happening, that story, the first story has appeared in the Evening Telegram, and now the fellow from the Daily Star, the St. John's Daily Star, is down there, and he's saying that if you went to the railway station down in Trepassey, if that reporter went back there, there's no doubt in his mind that they would have taken him and raised him in the air, so they would have just tossed him out. They were pretty disgusted with him.
He went on to say the story about the goats and sheep and ponies is pure invention. The Yankee sailors also resent the insinuation that they reflected on the village and the people, and no one here say any long faces on them. On the contrary, they were pleasingly surprised to find that their rendezvous was cast in such a pretty spot and not as they believed when on the way, in some isolated hamlet cut off from communication with the outside world. Neither the Yankee sailors nor the people thanked the writer for his effort to misrepresent both and cast ridicule on the intelligence of the people of this place.
So that's the Daily Star, and they're basically saying that the Evening Telegram has been down to ridiculing and making fun of the people of Trepassey. And so then the Evening Telegram said, we're not taking this. And so what they did then, they told their Star reporter. So
who was the Star reporter?
The Star reporter is a fellow named Billy Murphy, and they call him the King of the Newsboys. And so they take their best reporter, and they say, you go down to Trepassey, and you start sending back stories back to us here in St. John's.
So Billy left with a large stock of postcards, goods, and a big batch of telegrams.
And he went on down to Trepassey, and then he started reporting from Trepassey. And so then the telegram was saying that every word of his dispatch from Trepassey, it's true. It's God's word.
Yeah.
You know, you can't challenge it. And he referred to the Daily Star as a silly article, a silly, silly article.
He wrote, the public must not regard seriously a paper that receives a few dozen words and then adds and pads about 10 times as much to it, the addition being pure conjecture.
So basically what's happening, the telegram realizes they didn't even have a reporter down there. They were getting a few telegrams from local people down there describing what was going on, and then the writer here in St. John's was just embellishing.
He was
writing stories based on what was being
the few telegrams that he'd received.
And so then the telegram then said, well, now, they're going to pull out their big guns. Uh-huh. And so there was a young fella who was only 19 years old.
Anybody we know?
Oh, 19 years old. He's living here in St. John's. He's a reporter with the Telegram, and the Telegram says, we're going to send you down to Trepassey as well.
Who was that?
That was Mr. J.R. Smallwood. So Mr. J.R. Smallwood is 19 years old. He's on the staff there at the Telegram. And so he goes down. And apparently what he does, based on what we know, he must have made friends with a number of people, but he certainly made friends with a fellow, Mr. Band, Balkan S. Band. So Balkan Band was the chief radiograph officer and one of the troop ships, the USS Prairie. And and we know this because a Band, when he left Trepassey from his ship, he wrote a letter to Joey Smallwood back in St. John's, dated May the 30th, 1919. And in that letter, he said to Joey Smallwood,
"Your papers, the Evening Telegram, were received with great delight, and I must express my own and also the staff's appreciation of their contents. The Telegram is as good as any paper in the little old city of New York."
So he's saying the Telegram
is compliment.
Just, isn't that something? Yeah. So now that's some smack in the face that the reporters at the Daily Star too, isn't it? But then he goes on to say that the 9/10 of that crew that's on the Prairie, the naval vessel that were in Trepassey, you know, they had a grand time. And he goes on then to talk about some of their experiences there.
He says, Trepassey's full of entrepreneurs. Many homes gave us suppers for the small amount of 50 cents, and it was some supper. About 4 good fresh eggs, a large piece of ham, and many cups of coffee or tea as you could drink, and homemade bread and butter. If you were to call for a supper like that in New York, I'm sure it would cost you $2.50 easily.
So clearly what's happening, these 8,500 men, or some of these men, are certainly walking around Trepassey, and the local people in Trepassey are saying, come on in by and have a meal with us, have a bite. And they're charging them 50 cents a head, but in New York, that would cost about $2 a head.
He wrote, when the Prairie was passing out of Trepassey, many people were seen on the beach waving, and many fishermen blew 3 foghorn blasts. In return, the Prairie gave 3 long blows of her whistle upon approaching the end of the harbor. The lighthouse gave 3 whistles, which were also returned by us. Wishing you and your paper all the success possible, I am your sailor friend, Mr. Balkan S. Bond.
So it's a wonderful letter, and it talks about, you know, 2 established newspapers at the time vying for, you know, the same audiences, really. And it really gives you a great insight into what's happening in one community in Newfoundland 100 years ago.
There you go. For the folks in Trepassey, a little more history on the American visit back in 1919. When we come back, we're going to talk about springtime and icebergs in Newfoundland when Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
Springtime in Newfoundland and Labrador usually means northern visitors.
And they, we all know, are icebergs. Beautiful, beautiful icebergs, always off the coast of Newfoundland. And, it, you know, this is May month, June. That's when we get our beautiful bergs.
And we talk about Newfoundland growlers. And we can talk about the hockey team, or we can talk about the icebergs.
Let's talk about the icebergs, because I don't know much about the hockey crowd.
Right. Mammoth and majestic. So, mammoth. I mean, there's so many wonderful pictures of icebergs.
And, in fact, there was one iceberg from last season or the season before that is now one of the country stamps. So there was an iceberg that was taken down in Trepassey.
Yes, I know that one, yeah.
Because we had it on exhibit here at the rooms.
How many icebergs from this province have wound up on Canadian stamps? Or stamps?
I know for 2 for sure.
Yeah, okay.
One actually is the Newfoundland stamp, and the other was the more recent. It's the Canadian stamp. And icebergs have always been something that people have observed. Mm-hmm. So as early as 1527, there was an English explorer here, John Rutt, and he observed that the great islands of ice inhabiting our waters. So he was talking about the icebergs that were basically surrounding Newfoundland, and that was going back to 1527.
Ice has played such a large role in our history, icebergs and people going to the ice to hunt seals, and of course ships being damaged or sunk by ice, the Titanic, of course.
That's right. So since the 1790s, sailors have been sailing and later steaming to the ice floes. And so ice has always been not only something of beauty, but very much something that's been part of our commerce when you consider the ice and the sailing industry.
And there's a lot to understand about ice and icebergs.
There is so much. Like, so you often hear the expression, oh, it's just the top of, that's just the top of the iceberg.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that really means that whatever we see on top of the water, typically just a more substantial part of that iceberg is under the waters.
Small icebergs are particularly dangerous.
And the difficulty there, of course, small icebergs are one to flip. We know because a lot of the ice comes in, icebergs come very close to our land.
Yeah.
And we've known people who've actually swum out there and gotten on these icebergs, and these icebergs have topped over.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then what happened, you know, you're going to get quite the surge because the larger part of that ice, as I already mentioned, is under the water.
So the earliest recording usage in the Dictionary of Newfoundland English from 1865.
That's what's one of the earliest references. And
that was a growler, wasn't
it? The word was growler to describe that piece of ice that was described. And a growler, I guess, because it's in near the shore, and it's that noise, that growling noise.
I see, okay.
That's
okay.
Where that would come from.
Then what is a clumper?
A clumper is, again, it's a small parcel of ice, so it's a lump or a mass of ice, and there's actually references to clumpers going back to the 1800s in the Dictionary of Newfoundland. So it's a small iceberg, a floating pan of ice is another way of putting it.
And then you have a ruler? R-O-O-L-E-R?
A ruler is a small iceberg that tips over easily. So that's one of those that, you have to be particularly careful with. So Philip Tocque, back in 1846, makes reference to these smaller icebergs that would topple over.
And a rolling pan. Sounds like something you'd cook with.
It sounds pretty good. But it's a small iceberg rocking in the seawater. So it's a one that's constantly bobbling about, and actually there's lots of references that into the Dictionary of Newfoundland as well, going back as far as 1842.
So we talk about sea ice, people avoiding it, but there are people who wade right into it.
There are people that have, they're just totally fascinated by it. And then there's a whole other language around. So the people who make their living from the sea, so for instance, we've got words like ice skipper, ice master, ice captain, ice hunter. Those are all words that reference people who make a living from the sea, especially the sea when there's ice about, when there's icebergs about.
I would suspect they're expert seamen then.
Expert seamen.
Yeah, for sure. Once on the floes, sealers became an ice party.
That's right. So imagine that. And that would not have been, and that's not the kind of party that we would want to go to. So these are men really, really at work. So it's all of these men gathered, and then it became known as an ice party. And they're out there on the ice with their pole or, the gaff, and they're out to prosecute the seal fishery.
And, of course, they call it ice work or ice fishing.
Ice work, ice fishing, and then you can go on an ice voyage, and there's all kinds of
ice skiffs.
These are all words, and most of these words are particular to Newfoundland because of our, the fact that we're an island, and we see the bergs on a regular basis.
You have bergy bits, and how big is a bergy bit?
So a bergy bit is 5 to less than 15 meters, and normally about 100 to 300 square feet in area. And another interesting word, I just thought about it, calving. So if you see a big iceberg off the coast, and that iceberg breaks apart and becomes a smaller berg, that's called calving. I just like the word.
So icebergs in drinks, because we have iceberg vodka, we have iceberg beer,
and
I'm told iceberg ice lasts quite long in a
well, one of the things that we do at the rooms, we actually have an iceberg wrangler.
Oh, yeah.
Not on staff, but we bring someone in. And so he goes out and he brings the iceberg in shore, breaks the ice, breaks bits of ice, bergy bits. We'll put it into containers. And so tourists, when they come to the rooms, actually have an opportunity to touch a bergy bit, a real piece of iceberg. And they love it. They love that because lots of tourists that come to Newfoundland don't get an opportunity to see a real berg. Here they are. They come into the rooms and they can actually touch it. And then on a Friday night, I'm not saying this being true, but if I was going home, for instance, and I was going to go home and make myself a nice drink or something.
An adult beverage.
Yeah. It'd be some nice to have a little piece of iceberg ice in it.
So what is bergy seltzer then?
Bergy seltzer, it's the sound, the popping of the compressed air bubbles that are in the ice.
Huh.
So if you have a glass of ice, some iceberg, and you pour, say, a refreshment in, or let's say scotch, well, you can be at one end of the room and your friend can be at the other end of the room and you can hear your drink sizzle. Are you getting thirsty?
I am. Yeah, everything you need to know about icebergs. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the rooms when we come back. When Archival Moments continues here on your VOCM.
Archival Moments. We'll be right back on VOCM. We now return to Archival Moments on VOCM.
And as always, we like to leave you with some of what's happening here at the room. So let's start off with the Harp Petting Zoo. When is that?
And now that is not a zoo in the traditional sense. So this is actually, it's on Sunday, May 26th, and that's at 2 p.m. So what's happening is that we're bringing in three harpists, Vicky Greenslade, Jacqueline Cook, and Alexa Laurie. These are all professional harpists, very accomplished. But they also like to talk about harping, and they like for people to see what goes into harps, how they're built, where they come from. They want to talk, not only make the music, but they also want to...
I guess you get the history of the harp.
Get the history of the harp and, you know, get a conversation going about the harp. So that's why they refer to it as the Harp Petting Zoo.
Now, I note that you have a lot of aviation attractions happening at the rooms.
Well, we just spoke about Trepassey and the aviation history of Trepassey 100 years ago. But 100 years ago in St. John's and in Harbour Grace, you had at least four crews and they were all trying to race across the Atlantic. So this is the month when Alcock and Brown, for example, are one of the crews, and they make the first flight across the Atlantic. So that's the 100th anniversary celebrations that are coming up. So here at the rooms, for instance, we want to be part of that history. And so we've got three attractions right now, and that's the overseas training section that's in the Royal Newfoundland Regimental Gallery.
That's right. We did have pilots in the First World War.
Oh, we did, yeah. And, you know, that's research that's still going on.
We paid for aircraft, too.
We purchased at least 10 aircraft during the First World War, so previous to 1918.
Huh.
And so this is brand new technology. So 1919... 100 years ago, this month, Newfoundland is on the cutting edge of technology. Everyone that's interested in aviation are here in Newfoundland, and what they're trying to do is prove that you can fly from North America, from Newfoundland to the to Europe.
Okay.
And so there's all kinds of crews that are doing that. The other thing that we have here at the room, we've got the Marquette for the, or that's a small model of a sculpting that was done to represent Alcock and Brown and celebrate their... Both Alcock and Brown are from Manchester area.
Yeah.
And so at the airport of Manchester, there's this sculpting.
Yeah.
And we have the Marquette for it, or the model that was used to make it.
Now tell me about the mailbag. You do have the mailbag to travel with them?
So Alcock and Brown, when they left Newfoundland, they carried with them mail from Newfoundland with Newfoundland postage stamps on it. and those were delivered over to Europe, and the mailbag eventually came back to Newfoundland.
Okay, and you had that in the Eleanor Gill Radcliffe?
That's in the Eleanor Gill Radcliffe Gallery, which is up on the fourth floor.
And tell me about Wednesday, May 29th, the story of a Muslim Newfoundlander.
So that's Salam Bai. So that's the story of a Muslim Newfoundlander. So this is a documentary that was done by someone talking about their experience of being adopted, really, by Newfoundland and Newfoundlanders. And so the documentary is going to be, the screening is here. And then there's a question and answer that will follow that.
And you also have a workshop coming up, or 120s at the Rooms is still happening.
The 120s are still happening, and we're always looking for experienced 120 players or card players that can help us introduce that game to a new audience.
And what's going on with Coffee and Culture this time around?
So Coffee and Culture is Thursdays and May the 30th. Now, most people are going to know Dr. Rick Cooper. So Dr. Rick Cooper has been a physician over, he was for years down at the old Janeway Hospital.
Yes.
And then moved over to the health sciences, the new Janeway. And so he's very interested in history. He's always been interested in history, and particularly he's been interested in children and health care for children. So he's exploring causes of health and health initiatives in Newfoundland between 1900 and 1950. He's particularly interested in the rate of high incidence of infant mortality.
Okay.
So I think most people are going to know Dr. Cooper because he's a practicing physician.
Yeah.
But he's a fine historian as well. He's after doing a lot of research in this area.
Now, you have a reception on the 31st, and this is part of the summer exhibitions that are coming up?
That's right, and so you have to come out for that. So that's Friday, May 31st, between 7:30 and 9:30. And what we're opening up a number of exhibits, but one of the ones that I'm particularly keen on getting people in to see and to experience is Future Possible, the Art of Newfoundland and Labrador, from 1949 to the present.
Okay.
So basically, we said to one of the curators, take a look at what's in our archives, take a look at what's in our art gallery, take a look at what's in our museum, and tell the story of Newfoundland from Confederation to the present day.
Okay.
So she's got a cover, or covers, I think, you know, Confederation, resettlement, the oil industry, you know, all of that has to be done. Everything that's happened since 1949, and you've got to do it in a painting or an artifact.
Okay.
Or a document.
Any idea how many paintings or artifacts are included in this?
There's 100 artworks
okay.
that are included
okay.
in it.
Okay.
So it's...
And Billy Gauthier is here.
So Billy Gauthier is going to be another exhibit that's going to be opened on May 31st as well. It'll be available. And so he's a sculpting is his area, mm-hmm. his specialty of Inuit and Métis ancestry. So it reflects his cultural reality.
All right, and that is Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 3. So,
and I should mention that on Monday, May 22nd, we actually have a speaker in who's talking about the Alcock and Brown flight. But he's talking about it from a poet's perspective.
And what date is that again?
And so that's on Monday, May 27th.
27th, okay. So put that in your
2
calendar.
At 2 p.m. Put that in your calendar.
All right, folks, listen, you can join the Rooms, become a member, and you'll get the email blast that includes all this information. But if you do get an opportunity, come on out and enjoy the Rooms and the many exhibits that are here. Larry Doe is a director and archivist here at the Rooms. I'm Brian O'Connell. We'll be back again next week with another Archival Moments here on your VOCM.
Join us next week as we celebrate the colorful history of Newfoundland and Labrador with Archival Moments on VOCM.